Hi, I'm Rich Scott, Chief Medical Officer at Genomics England. It's my pleasure today to be guest hosting today's episode of The G Word. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses. Hope, fear, anger. And there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. So you and Bernie, welcome to the podcast. You are, and this is a long list, you're Deputy Director of EMBL, Director of EMBL EBI, you're Chair of the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health, you're a Non-Executive Director at Genomics England and an advisor on a number of companies, including Oxford Nanopore Technologies, Dovetail Genomics, GSK, and you're also one of the world's most impressive bioinformaticians. It's great to have you on the podcast. Welcome.
Well, I'm actually Deputy Director General of EMBL.
Apologies. So today we're going to be talking about, you know, loads of the things that you've been involved with over the years. I thought maybe we would start by talking about the Human Genome Project. You were a really big part of that. Tell us about how you came to be involved in the world of genomics initially, and then I bet there are some great stories about the Human Genome Project as well.
Yeah, I was very lucky. When I was a student, I fell into bioinformatics and understanding DNA. And that was even before I did my PhD. And then as I did my PhD, I worked on understanding DNA, and it was with Richard Durbin at the Sanger Institute. And I got involved in the Human Genome Project in analysing the data there, particularly with my two colleagues, Tim Hubbard and Michelle Clamp. Michelle is now in Boston. She mainly paints watercolours, actually. And Tim is involved in genomics, but inside of the NHS. What we really got involved in is trying to decode the human genome, trying to understand it by analyzing it in computers. I'd written some software that found protein coding genes in the human genome. And as the Human Genome Project generated more and more sequence in the late 90s, Michelle, myself, and Tim focused our energies. We brought a team together around us. That became the Ensemble Project to analyze the human genome. And it was exciting. It was really, really good fun. Lots of late nights, lots of doing things for the first time. And you mentioned stories. I have a whole host of them. But one that is often retold, because it's quite fun, actually, is one where in the 2000s, it was kind of unclear how many genes, how many protein coding genes there were in the human genome. So at a meeting at Cold Spring Harbor, I brandished a book and said, I will take bets. I will take a sweepstake set of bets on how many genes there are in the human genome. And this was in front of, you know, four Nobel laureates and all sorts of people in genomics. And everyone bet. And of course, to have a bet, you needed to have a definition. So there's quite an interesting definition of a protein coding gene at the front of that book. And we accepted bets, or I accepted bets on that day for $1. And then in a year later, you paid $5 to buy a number. And 2 years later, you paid $20 to buy a number. And we said that 3 years later, from the sort of generation of the draft human genome, we would know how many protein coding genes there were. Now, when 3 years came around, that actually wasn't the case. We didn't actually know how many. It ends up being sort of more complicated, and there's more edge cases than one imagines in finding out the precise number. But thankfully, everyone was too high. Everyone who bet in the first 3 years had bet way too high. So in some sense, it was very clear, although we didn't know the number, the precise number of human protein coding human genes, we definitely knew who was the winner of the sweepstake. It's a lady called Lee Rowan. And I persuaded Lee to split her prize, and she accepted with the next two people who were very close to her. And that was particularly to capture Hugues Roast Crolius, who's a Frenchman that worked with Jean Weissenbach, because he had given the closest number on the first year. And he had really, really come down through analysis that he did by comparing the Fugu genome to the human genome. And we all thought he was a little bit French and mad, but in fact, he was by far the closest to the number in 2000.
It's fascinating, isn't it? It's the number, and I know I've previously used the figure of the, I think it's 20,000-ish, isn't it, that we ended up thinking that that's the right number, that I think the starfish has about 20,000 as well. And it's one of these things where I wonder what lessons there are in untangling what our attitudes are to the genome and what genes, as opposed to other bits of the genome, do, that actually this number, just like the number of chromosomes, is actually far less important than you might think.
Yeah, it was naive to think that we should have a very big number, because we often think of ourselves as big and complicated. We're not. We're a pretty standard mammal or vertebrate or indeed metazoan. And the other thing to realise, of course, is that it's not really the number of genes which matter. It's how you use them, quite literally, how you switch them on and off and everything else. So clearly there's a lot of complexity in the human genome, not by the types of genes, the sort of building blocks, the types of Lego, but how you put that Lego together inside of each cell, which genes are on, which genes are off. And, you know, it's still unclear, just very unclear about how all of that works. I was involved in a project later on called ENCODE, which was the first stab at trying to work out which things were switching things on and off. And again, it was one of those head-scratching moments when we first looked at this, that there was a lot of places that showed biochemical the presence of molecules that we knew in other situations definitely did something important, but they were also binding in many, many places across the genome. And that was confusing. I think we're much more comfortable with that now, but it certainly was an interesting observation, let's put it that way, about just how complicated the genome is, but it's complicated in ways that you might not at first expect.
And I guess that's quite striking. I think, you know, thinking back to the announcement of the first draft of the human genome, it was this big moment. And that was, like, it was amazing, you know, the Tony Blair, Bill Clinton sort of announcing this amazing international sort of, yeah, international effort. And I guess also in a way it sort of simplified what had been done and perhaps put an emphasis on it being done. And I'd be interested to know what your sense is of that. Paint a picture for listeners on, like, where we are on the journey through what, as you said, it is really complex.
So the first thing I definitely remember thinking, this is the start. It's definitely not the end. And although we use the word done, it was much more like it's the start of, you know, using the human genome. And we had a lot of steps, even to where we are now, of things that we had to understand. And one was where these switches were. Another absolutely critical one was just understanding the variation, the differences in DNA across the globe, across humans. As with a lot of technologies, we overestimated the short-term gains, and we probably underestimated the mid to long-term gains. And so some things happened very, very quickly. So, for example, non-invasive pregnancy tests, where you take the blood of pregnant women and there's enough fetal DNA in the blood for you to work out whether the fetus is almost certainly whether they've got trisomies, particular chromosome 21, so Down syndrome. And that was a technology that went from a sort of idea to implementation incredibly quickly. And I'm not sure anybody predicted that. On the flip side, I do remember everybody saying in the 2000s that we were going to do pharmacogenomics, that we'll all have our genomes done, and when a doctor prescribed a drug, they would look up in the genome whether this drug had an adverse effect. And it's ended up being that that's much harder thing to execute, both because of the research and because of the operational difficulties in how you actually deploy something like that. So it's been incredibly interesting. And it's actually one of my passions to help bring the research that I've been involved in all the way through into operational delivery. And that's why I'm such a proud non-executive director of Genomics England, is really seeing that transition from a genomes for research use to genomes for actual clinical use.
Yeah, and I was reflecting, it's what's quite striking about you is that you are, you know, labelled as a bioinformatician, but actually a lot of your passion is in the technology that's just around the corner that can, that might be able to suddenly open up new avenues, rather than just picking up the same problems with today's technology. What are the biggest things that have happened in the last, since the Human Genome Project, to really like open new avenues?
Yeah, there's so many. The first thing to say, I think, is really bioinformatics is data science in biology or in molecular biology. It's just that we were a field that needed this new science. And because we were the first field and it was early, we gave it a special name. So we've got this special name, bioinformatics. If this science arrived now, we would just call it data science in biology. So in some sense, bioinformatics is this using data and using statistics in the biological context. I think there's been all sorts of shifts and I just get excited all the time about this. So one is the sorts of things that we get associated, or I see through Genomics England and through other places across Europe and the world, of actually using this to help diagnosis and patients. It's a real privilege to be involved, you know, in some way in that process. But then we've just completely opened our mind up in other areas. So the evolution of vertebrates and of mammals and all sorts of weird and wonderful things that you would have never have really guessed unless you had genomics to look at them. And then at a finer scale, this amazing fusion of genetics and history and archaeology and the recent evolution of our species, which is, again, another sort of fascinating topic. And that merges with the kind of ancient history, what we would call ancient history, and even quite recent history, which now genetics can give us a new view on those things. So when is all of this going to end? It's never going to end. I'm definitely going to retire working and with more problems to solve. You know, this century is going to be a century of understanding not only us as humans, but all living things. It probably won't be finished this century, but it's pretty exciting to be part of all of that.
Yeah, and I think that's a really big sell. One of the things I love about Genomics England, as someone who's come from a medical and non-data science background, is these amazing people who are now joining, who come from a data science background, from all sorts of stables, but are putting their brains to these problems. Because as you say, bioinformatics is a label we use in a particular context. And I think the sorts of questions that you can solve in the sorts of areas you've described and the sort of work that one can apply in healthcare using data science nowadays are so exciting. And we're getting great talent.
And the other thing to realize is that I think, yeah, certainly when I was a student, I had a strong sense that healthcare and practice was a long way away. It was like a different planet from research. And you know, one almost had to kind of set off on a spaceship from planet research to arrive on planet healthcare. But what's happened has been these worlds have really just come totally together. And from this perspective, humans, I think, are very interesting because we're an organism that we study in quite an intense way because we have this thing called healthcare. We invest, as well as investing so much money, we've got so many technologies like imaging technologies and molecular technologies and ways of measuring the things in blood and all sorts of different ways of measuring humans. And so that makes humans a really interesting species to look at from a research perspective. Now, of course, we can't manipulate humans. We can't make genetically modified humans. We can't tell humans how to live their lives and other things. So there are some aspects of the way we think about research, which are just you're just not allowed to do it in humans for ethical and practical reasons, but ethical reasons above all. But it's quite interesting thinking of this from a research perspective, not necessarily a healthcare perspective. Human has become a really, really good species to study. Now, I should stress, because I often talk with my, I have a kind of basic research side as part of EMBL, the European Molecular Biology Laboratory. We love species from all sorts of different places. And I have a particular passion for Japanese rice paddy fish as well. It's really powerful to be able to move between different examples of life on Earth and understand how they work. And that's what I do with a lot of my colleagues across AMBL, across Europe, across the world.
Tell me about these fish. I'm busily Googling in the background.
So Japanese rice paddy fish, madaka fish, are little fish. If you grow up in Japan, you will have fished them out of your grandfather's rice paddy or little stream or the little place that you go to for your summers. So they're very ubiquitous fish in Japan. And they have a very long history with genetics. In fact, the first sex chromosome crossover in 1921 was defined in madaka fish. Before, I should stress, the discovery of DNA. So the genetics predates the discovery of DNA as the source of hereditary information. But the reason why I kind of fell in love with them is you can inbreed them from the wild. So if you take wild madaka fish and you take a male and a female, and then in every generation you always breed brother and sister, brother and sister, and brother and sister, and brother and sister, about 50% of the time they breed true to near full homozygosity. And basically not many other vertebrates do this. In fact, virtually none from the wild. So laboratory mice sort of do this. But in fact, when you take wild mice, they won't really inbreed at this level. Humans certainly don't do this. The Spanish royal family in the 17th century had a go, but didn't really work out. So you don't get these homozygous individuals. So what we've done is we've taken a little patch of Japan, literally a sort of rice paddy. It's a bit of an industrial estate as it happens, but anyway, section there. And we fished out some wild madaka fish, so we know they all came from the same population. And then we have inbred them so that we can recreate the same genetic individuals again and again and again and again. And that's very powerful because, Richard, you're a human geneticist, and so you know it's like having endless identical twins. So we have 80 lines where we can produce as many instances of those individuals again and again. So it allows us to ask questions that we simply can't ask in many other settings because they're both wild and they're reproducible. So we can they have wild genetics and they are a reproducible population.
Amazing. So let's change tack a bit. One of the things, in fact, one of the contexts where I think I first heard you talking about humans as the sort of the model organism of the 21st century was as chair of GA4GH, the Global Alliance for Genomics in Health. So tell us a bit about what GA4GH tries to achieve and why it is that you sort of jumped at the chance of sitting at its helm a few years ago.
So GA4GH is, we're an international standard setting body. In some sense, we're a bit like W3C. So W3C is the World Wide Web Consortium. It's run from a number of institutions headquartered in MIT in Boston. It develops the standards, the web standards that we're using at the moment to have this conversation, that you type into your web browser, HTTPS, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that your mobile phone uses every day. And all of those standards just work. And we want to have the same kind of mindset for the genomics standards so that researchers can access genomics data responsibly in many, many locations. The reason why I jumped into it, and in fact, EMBL EBI, the institute I'm a director of, really put a lot of muscle behind it, is we realized that we needed to build this bridge in standards to the clinical world from the research world. And we need to bring expertise and technology and standards to the clinical world, but we also wanted responsible access to clinical genomes to be able to study humans. So this is secondary use of genomes for research. And just to stress, that research is always vetted. So someone says, yes, this is a good piece of research. I think these people should be allowed to do this piece of research. And the other thing, which you know, but it's often unclear, is that we always work with anonymized data sets. So we never get exposed to individuals' kind of addresses or names or those sorts of things. We're always working in a kind of slightly weird, just with these blank identifiers world. But we wanted to make that world work, this bridge between research and clinical practice. And to do that, we needed standards. And so we decided as an institution that we should make this commitment. And myself took the opportunity of being chair, but many of my colleagues from MBLEBI have participated in all sorts of different ways, including the new chief standards officer, Susan Fairley. So it's interesting. It's great to see organizations like Genomics England, but also the Australian Genomics, the H3 Africa, headquartered in South Africa and in Nairobi, groups around the world, the Japanese group, GEM Japan, coming together to help develop these standards. And I think it will really help research and clinical practice in the future.
Yeah, I really enjoyed being involved in it in the way that I have been. And one of the things that really struck me is how actually probably the rest of the clinical and healthcare data world could learn a lot. And particularly, I guess one of these things I've wondered about, and maybe it's me being unkind on the genomics world, is it's almost a bit like a leapfrogging exercise where, because it's a relatively new science, the standards could be written afresh. But what do you think, there are lessons for the rest of the healthcare data world?
So I actually do the opposite. I draw a big analogy between genomics and imaging. And if you go back to Rötgen's discovery of X-rays in the 1890s, in fact, the day after he famously took a picture where you could see his wedding ring via X-rays and his bones. And the day after, he wrote in his diary, this will have medical applications. Okay, so the person who developed the technology by serendipity immediately realized that seeing inside the body was going to be powerful. Now, as it happens, the medical community at the time did not leap on it. They were pretty skeptical, in fact. And there were a variety of reasons why. But one of the most colorful parts of this story is that the technology gets picked up mainly by fairground owners in the East Coast of America. And they have X-rays for fun. So you go to the fairground and you get your what's called bone portraiture. So you would get an X-ray picture of your own bones and you would hang it up in your drawing room. So people would walk in to have dinner. And they'd say, oh my gosh, that's a skeleton. You say, no, that's not any skeleton. That's my skeleton. And the medical community found this pretty distasteful, actually. And they found it even worse when a whole bunch of people turned up with really odd cancers, in particular the people who were operating this fairground portraiture, because they were using pretty harsh radioactive material. So at that point, a whole bunch of clinicians wrote in saying not only were X-rays not very useful in medicine, but they were actively dangerous. They should be kept away from all medical aspects. And it took quite a long story that involves hip dysplasias and all sorts of things. And then Marie Curie in the First World War going, helping French soldiers to make X-rays a part of medical practice. So I find that story of how a technology comes into medicine has some analogies with how genomics has come into medicine. In particular, this direct-to-consumer genomics that we've had is extremely similar to the fairground portraiture of X-rays. I have to admit, I've done it myself, and I'm very proud of my own genome 23andMe. But that's not actually the same as using it in medical practice. So, I mean, it's an interesting question whether genomics has kind of leapfrogged things and can set new standards, or whether we're actually yet another technology that medicine has to internalize. And I think it's better to talk about it that we're another technology for medicine to internalize. And from that perspective, I think we should think of it, you know, crudely the same way. Every clinician should have a working knowledge of genomics in the same way that every clinician has a working knowledge of x-rays. But there are specialists and expert departments that actually do it, that if there's something complicated on the x-ray, you take it to the radiologist, you say, you know, this looks weird, can I get your opinion on this? And there are people who push that technology forward. So I think it, just as we have departments of radiology and we have a clinical discipline called radiology, I think we should have departments of genomic medicine, or whatever we call it, and we should have a clinical discipline of genomic medicine, which is kind of first-class clinical criteria.
I love that parallel. So tell me what, how you've experienced the equivalent of your skeleton on the wall, your 23andMe. What was that like for you? Because you obviously have an unusual take on it because of your background.
Yeah, I do. It was, you know, it told me a lot of things I knew, my hair color, my eye color. It didn't tell me everything. I did have a conversation with my parents and my wife before I clicked on the APOE genotype. And as you know, Rich, APOE is probably the most common variant where we really know its clinical impact. If you have two bad copies of APOE from both your parents, then you're very likely, if you live to an old age, to get Alzheimer's. So I was a bit concerned, and I was actually most worried about finding out if I was heterozygote. So one bad, one good, because it would really change the odds of whether one of my parents were. Now, interestingly enough, my parents kind of had assumed that I had already had a big rummage around everything and looked already. So they were totally fine with that. And my father immediately said that he wanted to be genotyped. So it was the story that went in the opposite direction. But that does tell you something about genetic information. My genetic information, if I know my genetic information, I know stuff about my parents and I know stuff about my children. And as you know, as a clinical geneticist, there are some conversations you have to navigate there, which you don't have to navigate in other settings. But what I found most interesting in retrospect is 23andMe at the time, so they don't do that now, but at the time, they pretty confidently declared that I was likely to be lactose intolerant. Now, this is one of these gloriously complicated stories of genetics. So just to kind of tell you the story from how we now understand it, the ability to digest milk in adulthood is not a common thing in mammals. So all mammals can digest milk before they've been weaned, so where they're drinking their mother's milk. It's an absolutely critical part of being a mammal, but virtually all mammals shut it off at the point of weaning, so you no longer make this enzyme that digests milk. In human societies, a number of times we have had a mutation and we've then selected for people who can drink milk. And those are basically societies in early farming situations that use dairy cattle. Now, in particular, that includes some of the founders of Europeans. In fact, not all Europeans, but some of the European founders did that. And one of these mutation types has become the dominant type in Europe. Now, I just want to skip ahead now and say that that's also present in East Africa. It's also present in the Levant in a different form. And it's present in, well, different places more than just East Africa. So it's basically all the different places that have taken up dairy farming. But the original piece of work about lactose tolerance was only done in Europeans. And when they looked at this, basically the signal, if you don't have the European haplotype, it was thought that you were lactose intolerant. And so the early 23andMe readout of this region of the genome used this data that was specific to the European haplotype setting. And in fact, I don't. I don't have the European haplotype there. I'm homozygous non-European or recent non-European there. It's quite interesting in itself. I wonder why. But at the time, I did the experiment. I took myself off milk. Nothing happened. I put myself onto milk. Had my cereal. Nothing happened. I am confidently that I'm lactose tolerant. I'm completely lactose tolerant. And I'm reasonably confident that I've got one of the other lactose tolerant haplotypes from, you know, one of the other places where it mutated. Now, this just tells you how poorly we understand. The knowledge that we have now will get updated in the future. And again, you know that in human genetics, we'll be able to say things now, and in 2 or 3 years' time, we may update the diagnosis. Importantly, we may make new diagnoses. In some sense, this is very exciting that we can update people as our knowledge grows. It's also, I think, for a clinician, quite frustrating knowing that in the future, there will be a better knowledge base or database to use when you analyze a genome. So that was a lesson in knowledge updating, as it were.
It's fascinating. And I think that point about, as a clinician, it's frustrating to know that. In fact, I was having a conversation this morning with a family in clinic who waited a long time for a diagnosis and actually have been told in the past a bunch of very certain things about their child, where actually one of the things that medicine just needs to learn full stop is knowledge gets updated. And you just have to expect that and be a bit humble about the way you communicate. The other thing that your story makes me think about, which I was just wanting to ask you about, that was an example of where making assumptions about sort of ancestry and knowledge based on particular communities who've been studied more than others can make you give, inaccurate or less good advice to people. Can you talk to us a bit about where we are in terms of delivering equal information and healthcare to people?
Well, I think, and the other thing is this very tangled mess we have between genetics and this word ethnicity. You know, I use the word European, and I'm sure most people sort of conjure up, have a vision of what that means without really asking the question, how does genetics relate to ethnicity? So I'll do this one first, because I think it's really important to stress just that, despite the fact that many, many people can quite confidently tick the box when you're asked, you know, please identify your ethnicity, and you're asked, you know, white, black, British, British Asian, etc., all these different categories, many people will tick one of those boxes quite confidently. And then there's this other box where you can fill something in. And then there's sometimes a box saying mixed race. Now, none of these boxes are really related to genetics, amazingly. I mean, it's a bit, most people think that this is, that what we're doing there is a process that's about genetics. And we're really not. In particular, this weird concept, Black African. From a genetics perspective, we are all Africans. We all came from Africa. So recently in our evolution, we came from Africa that we still, you know, the differences between your genome and my genome, most of those were differences that were created or came to higher frequency when our ancestors were wandering around in Africa 50,000, 100,000 years ago. And most people just don't believe you when you say this. They're like, this doesn't make sense. You know, and it's something along the lines of, well, all my cousins kind of look like me, and there's all these other people who look like me. And so that's my extended family. That's my unit. And that's what we mean by ethnicity. And it's somehow related to genetics. And of course, it's really, really easy when you start pointing out families which are mixed race, as we often call it, where you see, you know, my neighbors, first cousin is someone who has to decide whether he's going to tick the mixed race box or the Black British box. And he's definitely my cousin. So there's no getting around the genetic similarity between him and me. The genetics is incredibly obvious and clear. So we misplace this visual characterization of people as if it is something profound about their genetics. And the way, one way to think about this is we don't spend a lot of time classifying people by hair color. I don't say, well, you know, Rich, you've got blonde hair, I've got brown hair. Let's face it, we probably aren't that related. I mean, that's sort of crazy. We don't say to everybody who's got red hair, so which part of Ireland is your family from? No. You know, you've got red hair, so I'm sure your ancestry must go back to Ireland somewhere. So tell me the story from Ireland. So it's taken me a long time to get my head around the mismatch between this really common thing we do in society, which is classify ourselves and classify other people by ethnicity, has this massive mismatch to genetics. They are just not the same thing. Skin color, a bit like hair color, is genetic, but not much of the genome is involved in skin color definition. It's actually really complicated. It's one of those human traits which are hideously complicated, even worse than the lactose example. So I'm on a bit of a mission to try and explain this. Most people are amazingly skeptical about this. I think, Rich, most clinicians believe that the ethnicity box is a sort of somehow a proxy for genetics, and that's what they think in this process. And that's not to say that humans aren't different. Clearly, we're different. We come in different sizes. We're tall. We're short. We have different hair colors, and we have different skin colors. It's just that our skin color doesn't tell us much more than our skin color genetics. That's the only thing skin color genetics really tells you. Now, you've mentioned that we've got this other problem, which is that a lot of our studies have been in the developed world, and they've mainly therefore dealt with people who do tick the box. In the UK, it would be white British would be the traditional box they would tick. In America, they describe themselves often as European American. And there is some aspect here that we don't get to see some of the genetics, which is elsewhere. Now, in fact, this is less about, again, which box you tick. And far more importantly, I mean, we should just basically, in the best world, we do all of our genetic studies in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. We would get by far the best data from genetics. We'd make the most robust inferences, and then we could use that, in fact, across pretty much everywhere in the world. We might have to do a little bit here and elsewhere, but that would be the logical thing. But of course, Africa is less developed, it's less money, it's more complicated to do the healthcare side. I mean, there are these great scientists there, in particular colleagues in H3 Africa pushing this forward, but it is quite a long road. And so I think at the same time, in countries like the UK, it's really important that we just think very, very broadly about genetics, and we've got to oversample the communities where it's sampling is much harder for us. And so again, those are going to be the communities that tick the Black British box. But again, I must stress just how sort of crazy it is to put, you know, Somalis and Nigerians and Afro-Caribbeans and Black British in Liverpool into one big bucket and think that that's homogeneous. I mean, that's just not homogeneous at all. That's all of humanity is spanned by that genetics. And so it's really about having that inclusive human view of genetics.
It's fascinating and complex, and as you've sort of described, quite hard to talk about in many ways.
I think we've got to get used to talking about it. And what I've also learned is as well as talking about it, you've got to listen as well. So it's a two-way process, because I mean, what you discover, I'm sure there's someone who's listened to that, and they've, you know, there's some word which I've used which they've, you know, for them, this word means this. And so you have to listen carefully as well, in my experience.
One of the things, as you know, working with us at Genomics England, we're working and thinking quite a lot about the diversity of our data. And one of the things, in fact, I think the most important thing that we're doing as part of that work is wanting to engage and actually just have discussions with communities, but also scientists, and to understand what the challenges, what the things we can do that will be useful are. To your point, you know, thinking about particular communities where actually working closely with those communities will actually help everyone much more, etc. But actually having a discussion about it so we can collectively work out what the challenges are and what the things we can all do are to help.
I think that will absolutely help. Those discussions will actually take time. And that's not least because, I mean, you just can't have discussions like this without touching on racism and structural inequality. I'm afraid it's so, you know, obvious and in your face when you start this process. And there are communities very, very validly who say, you know, this is all fine, but I've got some more important conversations to have with you. You know, why is it that the community that I'm from, you know, find it so difficult to access healthcare? Why are we turned away? What is going on in these different places? So I think having that conversation is really important, but you have to realize that that conversation immediately gets linked to quite a hot potato in politics. And, you know, the conversation in the UK is a very different conversation from the conversation in France. It's a very different conversation from the conversation in the US. So that's another challenge where the science is quite international. We're all humans. It's all the sort of the same science. We are very lucky because our native language is the language of science. So English being the language of science, we can have these conversations in many settings. And yet when you have that sort of societal side conversation, it, you know, everything gets rewired completely. So it's going to be interesting, Richard. I don't think it's going to be a simple thing.
Absolutely. So one final question from me. This podcast is about trying to get 50 conversations around genomics, around sort of the healthcare, social issues, applied science, research. Your advice to us, we want, is what are the big topics you think that don't get enough attention that perhaps we haven't touched on today that you think we should be making sure we include?
Well, if we hadn't had that conversation about genetics and race and racism, that would have been right at the top of my list. I think it is very important that clinicians and society have a kind of feel for what genetics can do and what genetics can't do. I often wonder whether we shouldn't try and lobby the BBC or ITV to get a genetic storyline into EastEnders or to Coronation Street. You know, so maybe a breast cancer, BRCA2 mutation and a bit of, you know, misattributed parentage. I mean, I think it would make for a great storyline, but also would be a way of having a conversation or help bring genetics to a public without this sort of didactic teaching bit, which I think often gets in the way. There's lots of people who they don't want to be taught something else. They've got better things to do. And so I do think we need to think about how we have bigger conversations with bigger groups of people. And when we have bigger conversations with bigger groups of people, you need to think about how you structure that. So that's my thing. Why don't we get some BBC storyline editors in?
We'll get on it. Ewan, thanks. Thanks so much for joining the podcast. Thanks for your time.
Okay, great.
That's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to The G Word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about this series. I'd appreciate it very much. I've been Rich Scott. See you on the next episode of The G Word.